in that role.
You know, what's astounding, Michael, is you have Andrew being arrested. And here in the United States, we have not seen as much fallout. In fact, I think President Trump just said that the millions of pages of documents have exonerated him, though he was named over 1,000 times. Next up could be, is that right? The former British ambassador to the U.S., Mandelson, who also, interestingly, was a trade envoy. And there are questions about revealing information that was given over to Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting here and what's disappointing to some people, actually, is obviously this is a story about sex trafficking, about the abuse of numerous women. And it seems like where justice might be brought, it's on a different charge, which is sharing confidential information with a powerful person. In both cases, Mandelson and Prince Andrew, there are suggestions that maybe they were quid pro quos here. So when it came to Mandelson, he was sharing this information, which was market sensitive and which would have been useful to Epstein. And it seems that in return, what he was getting was Epstein's help in helping his lobbying firm after he left government or getting a job with JP Morgan. These seemed to be what he was considering. He didn't end up getting a job with JP Morgan, but he was clearly from the emails angling for one. With Andrew, we know that
we're going to have to leave it there. But we thank you so much for being with us with Novara Media in London. And today marks Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary. On the air, our first show, February 19th, 1996. We've got a show Nermeen as well here in this image. On Monday, we'll be celebrating Riverside Church in New York. Guests will include Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, Mazhab Abu-Toha, V, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and more. We'll be streaming the event live at democracynow.org. Happy anniversary, everyone.
Happy
anniversary, Nermeen.
This is KBOO Portland. Volunteer-powered community radio.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, February 21st at 4 p.m. for a special Black History Month roundtable discussion on The Motif, Reimagined, a Jazz Sensibility. We welcome four amazing contributors to Portland and Multnomah County civic life in a discussion on public health, politics, and protest. Featuring Dr. Gina Gulliam, Dr. James Mason, the Honorable Saran Kopp, and the Honorable Ron Herndon. That's a special Black History Month roundtable discussion during The Motif on Saturday, February 21st at 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Republicans in the minority resort to a familiar tactic, walking out of the legislature over transportation funding. Portland City Council has to shut down after anti-ICE protesters insist they need to take action on the controversial ICE facility in the city. And an Oregon congresswoman shares her thoughts about what she saw in the Epstein files. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 19th, 2026. I'm Annette Newell. So glad to have you with us tonight. Oregon Republicans walk out again this week, but as KBOO's Josh Salem explains, this time they don't lose their chance to run for re-election.
Republicans in the Oregon Senate were a no-show earlier this week, putting the brakes on Democratic plans to fire up one of the session's most controversial bills. When the Senate attempted to convene at 1:30 p.m., none of the chamber's 12 GOP members were present. That denied Democrats, despite their being in the majority, the 20-member quorum needed to conduct business. Experts believe this is related to transportation funding. The maneuver came as the Senate neared a vote on Senate Bill 1599, a Democratic proposal to move the date of a public vote on an increase to gas taxes and other transportation fees. Republicans have been adamantly opposed to moving that vote from the November general election to the May primary. On Monday, Senate Minority Leader Bruce Starr, Republican Dundee, and House Minority Leader Lucetta Elmer, Republican McMinnville, sent a letter to Secretary of State Tobias Reid, which suggested such a move would be illegal. The letter read, quote, "You, as the Secretary of State, entrusted by the people of Oregon with the integrity of elections, have a choice: comply with the letter and spirit of the law, or join the blatant partisanship in violation of law embodied in Senate Bill 1599, end quote. Starr, who remained in the Capitol on Wednesday, despite being absent from the Senate chamber, also said, quote, "We're looking for an answer from them, and at that point we'll have the opportunity to have further conversation. This is not unusual. The minority is hitting a pause button so we can have conversations with the majority," end quote. Reid, a Democrat, issued a brief response after Republicans launched their boycott, saying, quote, "I received and carefully reviewed your letter dated February 16, 2026. I took an oath to uphold the Oregon Constitution and the laws passed by the state legislature. I intend to keep it." The move was quite reminiscent of other Republican walkouts that dominated legislative sessions in recent years. In 2023, Republicans walked away from the Senate for 6 weeks to block Democratic bills involving gun laws and transgender care. The 10 senators who participated in the walkout then fell victim to Measure 113, the 2020 law that says lawmakers cannot seek re-election if they have at least 10 unexcused absences. The timing of SB 1599 has been a major focus of this year's legislative session. After Democrats passed a 6-cent gas tax hike and other fee increases last year, a signature-gathering campaign led by Republicans collected enough signatures to put the new taxes before voters in November. The timing is important because the GOP allegedly wants the unpopular gas tax to be on the same ballot on which many of the Democrats are seeking re-election. SB 1599 needs to be passed and signed by Governor Kotek by February 25th in order to get the gas tax vote on the May 19th primary ballot. Other bills involving gun control laws and abortion access would also be in question if Republicans continue to choose to block legislative action. Interestingly, the Republican senators did not receive an unexcused absence on Wednesday because members of the party had attended other floor sessions. For KBU News, I'm Josh Salem.
Experts from the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Health and Science University gave an update on the state's response to recent measles cases rising in Oregon and across the country. They also talked about new measles tracking methods. Dr. Howard Chio is the Oregon Health Authority's Medical Director for Communicable Diseases and Immunizations.
Measles cases have been increasing across the United States. So this year alone, there have been almost 1,000 cases reported nationally. In comparison, last year, there was around 2,300 cases nationally in total across the entire year. In Oregon, we are experiencing our first measles outbreak of 2026. With 5 reported cases since January 1st. It's really important to remember these likely represent just a fraction of the true number of measles cases, since not everyone who becomes sick will seek medical treatment or be tested and therefore may not be reported to us in public health. So today we are launching an Oregon dashboard that is going to share measles virus concentration levels directly from our wastewater surveillance system. We test sewage for infectious diseases, and this allows us to have an idea of how much disease there might be circulating in communities without relying on people who are sick to seek health care and then be reported to us in public health. The Oregon Measles Wastewater Surveillance System was launched last October, and data has already been viewable on the CDC National Wastewater Surveillance System webpage. However, the CDC website uses a very high threshold for calling a sample a detection or not, because it's designed to correlate with cases that are actually reported to public health. Instead, what we're doing with the new Oregon measles wastewater dashboard is to let everyone view viral concentrations in wastewater, and that's categorized as very low, low, moderate, and high. You'll be able to view this information by county over a two-week period. And I think this is actually really important because it will give the general public and healthcare providers additional timely information about the spread of measles in Oregon. For the two-week period ending on February 7th, there were 9 counties with low levels. For the two-week period ending February 14th, we've detected measles virus in 6 counties across Oregon.
And here's why that's especially important for families with young children. According to Dr. Don Nolt, a professor of pediatrics and interim division head for pediatric infectious diseases at OHSU's Dornbecker Children's Hospital.
I want to convey 3 points that I convey to my own patients, that measles is very serious, it's very contagious, and the vaccine very safe and really works. And measles is not just a fever and a rash. All children who get measles are absolutely miserable. Okay. It can cause serious complications, including pneumonia and inflammation of the brain, known as encephalitis, and in rare instances can cause death. And measles disease poses the highest risk to unvaccinated persons, such as those who are pregnant, infants who are under 1 year of age who really can't get vaccinated, and people with weakened immune system. And it's also very interesting in the past many years that it's understood that measles disease itself can be immunosuppressive and that you can be quite vulnerable to other infections for about 12 months after you suffer through your measles. The second thing I want to tell families after saying that measles is very serious is that it is extremely contagious. Measles spreads through the air, and contagious people can spread measles 4 days even before they have that typical rash. And the virus stays airborne in the area for 2 hours, even when the patient has left that area. So it really is around, not only in the air, but when people cough and sneeze near you. And the third thing I want to remind people in terms of how serious measles is and how contagious it is that vaccinations are so incredibly important and so incredibly protective. It's very safe. It is the best way to protect against measles, particularly if you've had 2 doses, because that is 97% effective. And like all vaccines, the measles-containing vaccine have mild side effects that go away pretty quickly, such as local injection site inflammation and redness and tenderness and fever. The thing that I'd like parents to remember is that this vaccine has been around since the 1960s. And so we have many, many decades of safety data and protective data to show that this is the best way to protect against measles disease. So I recommend all children get 2 doses of the measles-containing vaccine. If you're not sure if you or your child is protected, then talk to your trusted healthcare provider. Measles is here. Measles is on the rise in our area, in Oregon, throughout the United States. And I would encourage parents to reconsider their vaccine decisions.
Portland police arrested 4 people after anti-ICE protesters shut down a Portland City Council meeting Wednesday night. The protesters were angry about what they say is the council's inaction over a land use agreement that allows ICE to operate out of a facility in the South Waterfront neighborhood. It all happened as Portland City Administrator Raymond Lee updated the council and the community about next steps for land use violations against the ICE facility.
This past Friday, Portland Permitting and Development issued an administrative review decision upholding the land use violation at the ICE facility in South Portland. The property owner now has until March 16th, 2026 to correct the violations and has 10 business days to appeal this decision to the city code hearing officer. It's important to remember that this is just one step in the notice of violation case. We remain committed to following the process to ensure that the outcome is meaningful and defensible. City staff also continues the administrative rulemaking process for the detention facility impact fee code ordinance, moving with the urgency and the moment demands while also ensuring our actions are well executed and legally defensible. Currently, a multi-bureau working group is pulling together the information needed to ensure this critical ordinance is implemented. There are a lot of elements of the ordinance. They require new process development, and staff are taking this task very seriously. Our team is working with the ordinance sponsors, Councilors Murillo and Green, to align the ordinance intent with the city's implementation process. City staff continues to focus on establishing a temporary administrative rule first, as we still work on implementing a permanent rule also. So those two things are working in conjunction.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a disruption. This is a disruption of the meeting. This is a warning that if there is continued or other disruption of the meeting, the persons engaging in the disruptive behavior will face ejection from the meeting. Anyone refusing to leave the meeting, if security could please remove these individuals. Security, please remove the individuals who are here.
That was Council President Jamie Dunphy ordering a recess before the protesters started their advance on the dais. Beatrice Avara told the council members about their concerns.
I'm here today representing Portland Contra las Deportaciones and Revoke the ICE Permit campaign. City Council, many of you claim to stand with immigrants, and yet you do nothing to protect them. You have the ability to shut down the ICE facility, and you do nothing about it. Not only that, but councilors such as Angelita Murillo perpetuated the right-wing narrative that closing down the facility harms immigrants. This narrative, not only is it false, it's also evil to repeat. Removing the facility's permit only revokes the right to legally retain people inside the facility. So if DHS wanted, they could still have the facility open to do their check-ins. We also know that there are other options. During the COVID-19 pandemic, people were doing their check-ins online. That facility is not necessary. Revoking the ICE permit would end DHS, ICE, and PPB's ability to use the McAdam building as the central base for their operations. The only people who would get harmed by the facility closing are Trump and the regime of terror. The permit allows ICE to operate a detention center in that facility. That same permit also requires for detainees to be placed in shackles during transportation. In 2011, when the permit for the ICE facility was under review, there were these racist arguments that having the facility would put the community at risk. The city agreed with these racist individuals, and they rejected the initial application. Due to that, ICE had to create a safety plan that requires detainees to be placed in shackles when they're being transported to and from the facility. To my fellow organizers, if you have been detained near the facility by DHS, all for peaceful protesting, and you get booked and transported, this is why you got placed in shackles. This permit allows for this to happen. And this is what happens to every immigrant that gets processed through that facility. They get placed in shackles as if they were criminals, and they have to wear them the whole time while they get transported to the detention center in Tacoma. So to be clear, when you all speak out against revoking the permit, or when you advocate for the mayor to enforce the terms of the permit, you speak in favor of immigrants being placed in shackles. This is why we say the permit must be revoked and permanently removed. There is no other just solution.
And the city councilors themselves clashed about considering how to spend millions of dollars in unexpected housing funds. They decided to revisit that topic at a later date. Meantime, at the national level, members of Congress have been reading the Epstein files, some in an unredacted version. Among them, Oregon Congresswoman Val Hoyle. Here's her reaction.
D-A-R-V-O. It stands for Deny, Attack, Reverse Victims and Offenders. It is a classic way to control and abuse victims. I bring it up because I just got back from reading through some of the Epstein files. As the DOJ has made them available, but not easily searchable. So we have to go through bit by bit, but we're going to do it because these abusers need to be held accountable. So DRVO, deny. I read through emails between Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, and they denied that anything was real. They said that these stories were fake and these women were paid to say the stories. They said other people could verify that it wasn't true. Attack. They attacked the victims, saying that they didn't look underage, then said they wanted to come give massages. They wanted to bring their friends, and then reverse the victims and offenders. They talked about how inconvenienced their life had become since these brave women came out to say what had happened to them. Ghislaine Maxwell, even in one email, complained that she had to fly coach and was delayed 3 hours and got the flu because she wasn't flying a private plane. That their friends were falling out over this, that things were inconvenient and very rough. Not one point did anyone think about the victim. No. D-A-R-V-O. Know it when you see it, and know that I will continue to read through these files to expose the truth and to make sure that anyone in power that rapes children should be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law.
Young people in the Pacific Northwest are among those sharing their personal stories during this American Heart Month. They're talking about congenital heart disease, structural issues starting when they're born, affecting about one in every 100 people. One young Washingtonian now serves as a youth heart ambassador for the American Heart Association, speaking at schools about her journey to raise money for research. Isabel Charlet reports.
February is American Heart Month, and young people across Washington are sharing their journeys with congenital heart disease to spread awareness and hope. Congenital heart disease refers to structural heart problems people are born with, which affect about one in every 100 people. Among them is Hazel Hupp, a Wenatchee third grader born with a narrow aorta who underwent her first heart procedure before she was 1 week old. This school year, Hupp is serving as a youth heart ambassador with the American Heart Association, speaking at schools about her experience.
The reason why I'm doing it is to help raise money for scientists to make better technology to help kids with their heart surgery, just like I did. It's just the whole point of it.
After several procedures, including open heart surgery, Hupp now enjoys an active life and says she loves to play softball and golf. While CHD is the most common birth defect, advancements in research and treatment have dropped the death rate by 40% in the last 25 years. Congenital heart disease can range from holes in the heart to complex, life-threatening conditions, all caused by improper heart development during pregnancy. Dr. Nefti Sandeep at Mary Bridge Children's Hospital in Tacoma says this month is important because when most people think of heart disease, they think of adults.
But it's also important for others to realize that roughly 1% of all births in the United States, which comes out to approximately 40,000 babies every year, is born with some sort of congenital heart defect.
Sandeep says the heart is able to heal itself from some forms of CHD and others can be addressed with medication, but many kinds require surgery. While most CHD is diagnosed when kids are young, some people have structural heart problems they may not find until adulthood. Sandeep advises everyone to get regular doctor visits to check on your heart and take any heart-related symptoms seriously. I'm Isabel Charlet.
A new lawsuit is slamming what some groups call censorship at national parks in California and across the country. Suzanne Potter has that story.
A coalition of conservation groups, park groups, scientists, and historians filed a lawsuit this week against the Trump administration over censorship at National Park Service sites. President Trump ordered a review of all signs and educational materials to make sure they focus on natural beauty and grandeur and censor factual information that may disparage Americans, past or living. Kristen Brengel with the National Parks Conservation Association says staff at Muir Woods, north of San Francisco, recently took down an exhibit on the role of women in protecting the park.
We're seeing similar changes being made to parks across the country where either their brochures, exhibits, or signage is being flagged to be changed in order to not tell stories about slavery, climate change, women's rights, and indigenous history.
The Park Service is required by law to present high-quality education and peer-reviewed science. The administration is appealing a judicial order requiring Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia to reinstall an exhibit it recently took down about slaves who lived in George Washington's house. Rangers at Acadia National Park in Maine have taken down signs about climate change. Brengel says it's ridiculous to try to bury certain chapters in our history.
People like to know what's going on, not just the wonderful, cute stories. They want to know what's actually happening or what happened in those parks. And it just completely defies logic why you would try to hide certain parts of science and history from our parks.
The administration ordered signs posted at all sites with a QR code asking visitors to report so-called negative information about past or living Americans. Many people responded with complaints about the policy or compliments about park staff. The Park Service has lost 4,000 people to layoffs or forced retirements over the past year. I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new study examines Colorado's past racism amid federal efforts to de-emphasize its role in American history. Tribal advocates worry about the SAVE Act's potential impact on Native Americans. And the Trump administration finally turns over funding for the Gateway Tunnel Project. Here are some of the stories impacting our democracy in today's edition of 2026 Talks.
There is more that unites us as Americans than divides us. We all have a reason to be proud of our country. We all have a reason to also hold our country accountable because we know that we can do better.
Chloe Duplessis is with the Colorado Black Equity Study. For the 100th anniversary of Black History Month, she's part of a team looking at the history of systemic racism in the state. After in-person hearings, their findings will be turned over to a state commission and may end up in recommendations for repairing injustices, past and present. Nationally, the administration continues to dismantle diversity efforts and de-emphasize historical documentation of racism. The White House denies a video posted by President Donald Trump of former President Barack and Michelle Obama as apes as racist. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt points to Trump giving historically black colleges extra funding as an example of aiding black Americans. Native American voters say Republican legislation is threatening their civil rights. The SAVE Act would require proof of citizenship like a passport or a birth certificate to vote or register to vote. O.J. Simmons with South Dakota's Four Directions Native Vote says it adds barriers for tribal populations.
Legislation like this is only going to make it more difficult for people that want to participate to participate. And I don't think that's what the founding fathers wanted when they were talking about for the people, by the people.
Senate Democrats say they'll filibuster the SAVE Act, making it unlikely to pass. But another voting restriction bill has momentum in the House. The MEGA Act calls for all states to have a centralized voter surveillance system, a ban on mail-in voting, and banning ballots arriving after Election Day from being counted. After a several-month delay, the Department of Transportation is releasing funds for New York and New Jersey to continue work on the long-awaited Gateway Tunnel Project. The Trump administration withheld hundreds of millions of allocated dollars despite legal challenges. While speaking to Trump, New York Governor Kathy Hochul called the delay vindictive and destructive.
How can you throw them out of their jobs? How can you tell them to go home? How do they go back to their families and tell their kids, I'm sorry, I might not be able to bring in a paycheck because the president who promised to create more jobs in this country has laid me off?
Minnesota lawmakers are debating fraud prevention after scammers posing as service providers plagued the state's safety net programs. The state's taken steps through legislation and executive orders, but Mark Haveman with the nonpartisan Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence says there are renewed bipartisan calls for more.
I understand the fact that there are providers there who have been operating as they should and doing good work for the state of Minnesota that are feeling the effects of the actions that have had to be taken.
With questionable evidence, a conservative blogger blamed the fraud on the state's full Somali population. The White House cited those accusations when announcing the controversial immigration raids in Minneapolis. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network.
Hundreds of millions of dollars worth of broadband funding could impact Native communities in the West, and some Alaska Natives vote on whether to rebuild or relocate to higher ground. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The New Mexico Office of Broadband Access and Expansion has announced more than $900 million in investments towards broadband infrastructure with the help of both federal and state support. Some of the funds will go to the Navajo Nation. KUNM's Jeanette Didios has more.
Among the 17 projects announced, the Navajo Nation was awarded $111 million. That's the largest single supported project from the Broadband Equity, Access, and Deployment Program, also known as BEAD. Sonia Nez manages the Navajo Nation Broadband Office. She says the project will affect 11,000 households across New Mexico's portion of the Navajo Nation. She also says an effort to bring broadband to the community like this has never been done before.
Telehealth, education, across the whole spectrum, lifts the people up to a new level where there was no connectivity before, but now they will have connectivity at the home. And so it just opens a whole door of opportunity for the people. Businesses, entrepreneurship, education, across the whole spectrum.
Nez says tribal members continue to face challenges without broadband.
So without internet connection, for example, to get college education, you have to go off the reservation. You have to go into the cities, you know. So this will give them opportunity to have school right there at home and then not have to leave the nation, you know.
Nez says the BEAD program will help more homes have broadband service. She also says the Navajo Nation is working to establish broadband in all chapter houses and install 5G towers for mobile internet. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
Kipnuk was one of the Western Alaska villages hit hardest by the remnants of a typhoon in October. Residents are voting on whether they want to rebuild their community or relocate to higher ground. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden reports.
Raina Paul sits in an Anchorage office, scrolling through a spreadsheet filled with hundreds of names of Kipnik tribal members.
We're just like on A's.
Paul is in charge of the village's voting process. Over the next several days, she and her team will call every single adult tribal member, that's about 900 people, and ask them, do they want to rebuild the village in its current location or move to higher ground?
It's very important for us to find out what the tribal members from Kipnik want.
Last fall's disastrous winds and flooding destroyed homes and infrastructure and contaminated land and water. Most of Kipnik's residents remain evacuated, including Paul. She says she wants the future Kipnik to be safe.
We love our community. We miss our community. We're doing it for our future generations to come, because they might not know what to do when this happens again. I think we're just going to be hit with many, many storm events.
The first community meeting about whether to relocate happened about a week ago. The decision to start voting followed swiftly. Cheryl Musgrove directs the Climate Justice Program under the Alaska Institute for Justice. She says that